With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Anyway, you will never understand it, cause it happens too fast, and it feels so good, it's like walking on glass. It's so cool, it's so hip, it's alright, it's so groovy, it's out of sight. You can touch it, smell it, taste it so sweet, but it makes no difference, cause it knocks you off your feet.
Hello?
Hey Billy, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm alright, sorry, I wasn't trying to one-tone you then. I realised I hadn't connected you up to the desk. I was like, oh, he's going to think I'm one-toning him, and I expect him to call me back. How is life your side of the pond, my friend?
It's another day.
Yeah.
It's another day. Probably, different, but probably equal to your life on your side.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's the most frustrating and maddening thing for me. Obviously, you know, the loss of life is awful, and you feel for people, and I've got a couple of friends now that have lost parents, and it's just, you know, it's mortifying. Aside from that, it's just, I find the hardest thing about this current situation that we're all in, the continuing uncertainty of it, and the clear display of ineptitude. And
absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's, I imagine, exactly the same, if not even worse, your side. But it just seems like nobody knows what the hell they're doing, do they?
No, you know, it sometimes it takes something this extreme to happen when you really actually look at the problem you've been living with for a long time, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is when you find out, and we're finding out.
Where are you based? Where's home?
I'm in San Francisco.
Right, right. And so
we've had about a month and a half of fires here, which has been really fun.
Yeah.
We had a couple of days. I don't know if you knew about this, but the sun didn't come out one day. It was dark the entire day. It was like nighttime, but orange.
Wow. Like very post-apocalyptic.
Absolutely. I don't know. There's pictures on the net. You should check them out. That's exactly what it was like.
I saw like the kind of orange skyline because it just, I mean, it swept over all through California, isn't it?
It did, and it's been going, and there's still fires going even from like 2 months ago. They're still going. It's just massive. It's insane. And San Francisco's been pretty much, spared from that, though, you know, you can drive 20 miles and it's pretty bad.
Who have you been in lockdown and quarantine with? Who's been keeping you company this year?
Just my wife.
Just the pair of you. Well, that's better than solo. I've been solo
absolutely
for a lot of mine, and it's been,
oh really?
It's been a journey.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you been taking any kind of meditation or anything like that, or mind exercises?
I mean, I wrote a book, which was cool. So that kind of kept me preoccupied and distracted with something positive and productive for a large
that's
chunk
good
of it. But there's certainly been like waves of madness, and yeah, you kind
right
of go through it all because there's nowhere to run or hide. So you're really addressed in the same way you were saying a moment ago about how as countries we're being forced to deal with a lot of these perhaps realities that have been in place for a while. On a personal level, I think you're left with just only yourself and your thoughts for company, and
yes,
in the process of that, of course, you end up inevitably going back through the past and thinking
right
about the things that you've done and the things you should have done differently, especially when writing a book and going into yourself anyway. Have you been doing much writing yourself? Have you been being creative, or what have you been up to pass the time?
You know, it's really strange. I mean, we have this election thing going here that's been really unpleasant for pretty much everybody.
Yep.
And there's something about, if I'm talking musically speaking, you know, I always enjoyed playing. That's why I like to do it. And, you know, when you take this kind of pleasure out of things, it's harder. It's actually harder. I have been writing, but not like with the enthusiasm that I had in the past.
When was the last time you jammed with anyone?
You know, I did. I have made a makeshift studio at home, so I have been collaborating with people on stuff.
Nice.
Doing remixes and stuff like that. So that's been pretty cool. But, you know, it's not a lot of fun, you know. Definitely not a lot of fun. And, you know, what's really weird is we have this thing on my block where we have every Saturday, all the neighbors come out and do a happy hour. We kind of stand outside on our steps and drink, right?
Nice. And my road was doing that. Yeah.
That's a great thing, you know. I mean, we get to know each other a lot better. I mean, because we all live on the same block, right?
Yeah.
And we've been doing this for about, you know, 6 months now. And I'm starting to notice, you know, with the lockdown that I'm less inclined to actually talk to people. I don't listen as well as I used to, because I mean, I'm used to hearing myself.
Yeah. It's funny. I did exactly the same thing on my street. We'd have like quite a big space out on the sort of shared front drive area, and because pubs were shut, and I was certainly, you know, in need of any kind of social activity because I'd been you know, with my own company for so long. So we started doing that every Friday night, and it was actually the first time. I've since left that place now. I've moved out of London. I had to get out, but I was in that flat for a year, and that whole time before lockdown, I'd never spoken to a single neighbor once. And then throughout that process, we came on first name terms with a lot of them and, you know, formed legitimate relationships. And I did see a lot of positives, which I'm sure you did too at the very start. And it continued for a while of like people really chipping in and getting into that idea of community and we're in this together.
Right. And so then, you were in London then, right?
I was in London.
For a while?
Yeah, I was in London.
So, you know, that became a very stressful place to live before this thing hit anyway, right?
Yeah.
And here as well, I mean, San Francisco is, you know, Silicon Valley. I mean, it got very expensive for people to live here. And people were working hard and, you know, coming up empty. And this thing actually was a relief to a lot of people.
Did you grow up in San Fran, Billy, or did you move out there when you started Faith No More?
Yeah. I grew up actually in Southern California, in L.A., but moved up here when I was 18, so that was 40-something years ago.
And so you were in L.A. what, kind of like, are you old enough to remember the late 60s at all, or is it more 70s kicking it?
No, I remember the late 60s, I do, because I lived in Hollywood, so kids in my class, you know, I'd go play at their houses or whatever, and they lived off the Sunset Strip, so we would drive by the Whiskey A Go-Go and see all the hippies in the streets and all that kind of stuff.
Man, I can only imagine the sights, the smells that you would see down that road in that time period. It must have been an absolute like kaleidoscope smorgasbord of freaks and beautiful people and counterculture.
It was in a very California way too. Like,
yeah,
you know, there was, you know, people driving, you know, dirt bikes without helmets, and you know, it was a whole. There's a whole cultural thing. You know, people still worked on their cars out there. I mean, there was the era of the muscle car. Yeah, I remember it. It's funny because it's like a movie, but I remember it.
Did you see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? And did Tarantino do a good job of invoking that time?
So all my friends who I've known from that era, I've reconnected thanks to Facebook, right? They found me from like that I knew when I was like 6, 7 years old.
Right.
And so I've been talking to them for a couple of years, and they have all seen it. I haven't seen it yet, but they've all said you have to see it. He totally got it.
Yeah,
he got the vibe.
I heard that because, I mean, I obviously aren't really familiar with those streets in that time period, but I've since been there a lot of the time. And he's managed to put in like Frank and Musso and the Frolic Room and any of those places that were there then are all in the movie.
Right.
And you're like, whoa.
Cool.
And you grew up, am I right in thinking this? Did you go to school with Kevin Kerslake, or at least grow up in like the same neighborhood as him? So Kevin, I met a few years ago. What a sweet man he is.
Oh, he's great. He's 2 years older than me. He used to drive me to school.
No, so that you were really good buds.
His brother was my age. What?
You were really good buds.
Yeah, our parents went to high school together, if you could, you know, so it goes pretty close.
Wow.
Even though I haven't seen Kevin in 20 years, but I can say that Chris Lake's, you know, my father died 2 years ago and his dad came to my father's funeral, you know, so we're fairly close.
For me, he sort of single-handedly invented that kind of alternative rock MTV look. Like all of those bands and all of those videos that you think from that time, like a lot of them were made by him. Which one of yours did he do? Was it Midlife Crisis?
Midlife Crisis, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he did another one as well, though I can't remember which one it was.
And so you and Roddy also were like childhood neighborhood friends, right?
Right, since 10 years old, yeah.
10, that's amazing. And are you still, I know you're bandmates, but are you still close? You still feel like you haven't had enough of each other yet?
You know, I like connecting with him outside of the band, more like as the guy I know from back then than being a bandmate.
I love it.
Because we have this, you know, the thing about a band is, you know, you get defined by something like this. I mean, we had a little bit of success, so people kind of think of me and I'm kind of think of myself because that's how people refer to me as the guy in that band. And you know, the cool thing about knowing Roddy as long as I have is like we see each other from a completely different experience, you know, from sitting in Catholic school with nuns stuff wearing uniforms, you know, totally different. And that's actually probably closer to really who we are as people than just these guys in a band together.
How was going to, did you have Catholic parents? Did you grow up in a religious home as well?
We did. Yep. I'm sorry to say I did.
Or how does that shape your young mind as you're beginning to form your own opinions and, you know, figure out your relationship to the world around you? What role did religion play in your young adult life as you were getting out of school and stuff?
I mean, it was very strict. It was very... There's a lot of agendas with nuns, a lot of repression going on, and they kind of ran the school kind of like a more along the prison system. So really, it was all about lashing out to me. It was all about, you know, getting even and being subversive and finding groups of students and doing ways that, you know, to hit back. So it kind of gave me, and in a way, to my detriment, it made me very contrary to just about everything.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to work that out, you know, that I was, it's just, when you have an experience like that so young, you know, it shapes how you view the world in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think anything that happens to you between a certain age, whether good or bad, it's definitely going to just define your engagement with the world around you and your view on the world.
It will, though you can revisit it because obviously there's a lot of unconscious behavior that comes with that. And you know, I think that, you know, it's always behooves someone to get older to see what, you know, unconscious things motivate them so they can kind of, you know, control that rather than be controlled by it. So,
amen.
It is true. It does shape how I see the world. I can go there in a second, but I can say that I definitely don't have that, you know, I'm not with that, you know, reaction mode that I used to be. That's for sure. Thank God.
That was what it was originally like, though, was it? Was it a bit like, reaction?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. It's like, I'm going to get them back, you know? I'm going to get them back for what they did to me.
Yeah. That's that classic kind of angry teenage mentality as well, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, and all this, you know, the hype, you know, hypocritical politicians, like things like Donald Trump, for example, really kind of gets me on that Catholic school level because he's that authoritarian asshole who's ignorant, who's imposing his will on people. And it's like, that to me is like, just on a very personal level with my experience, it's like that doesn't fly. It doesn't work. Go fuck yourself.
Were you a punk rock fan as a kid? Like, were you into that whole Germs, X, Black Flag, that movement?
Absolutely was. And I went to all those shows. Yes. So I was, I learned how to play bass when I was like 13. And, the bands at the time that, you know, if you want to be a musician, a bass player, you know, you listen to prog rock basically, right? It was Yes. It was King Crimson. You know, the players, the technical players. And I was just learning. So these guys were way above my skill set. And I was like, it was kind of demoralizing. I just wanted to play in a band. And when punk rock happened, it completely clicked for me because I could be as bad of a bass player as I was and still put a band together and play gigs.
Who were the bands for you that most, you know, I guess either inspired you as a musician or really just set a light in you that desire to get a group of guys together and start playing your own shows?
I was playing with, you know, I mean, there was bands like Beatles and stuff like that, right, when I was learning. But Sex Pistols was a big one, real big one.
Love it.
Because it was powerful, it was aggressive, it was everything. You know, back in my Catholic school brain, it appealed to that very well.
Yeah.
and it was just like, it was hard. And it was harder than everything else, you know. And the whole world came with that. It was a whole, you know, it was a whole way of thinking. It was, you know, if you saw somebody walking down the street with a, you know, say a, like a button, a Sex Pistols button on, you know, just a little button. All of a sudden, this is somebody who's kind of like in the underground, you know.
Yeah.
He's kind of like a, you know what I mean? He's a
it makes
felon,
it easy
you know?
To spot
felonite,
your
you know?
Fellow tribesmen, doesn't it?
Exactly. That's right. That's right. And we had this thing where, you know, back, so you know, late 70s, you know, I was getting into it. I was, you know, 16, 17 years old, you know, coloring my hair and, you know, doing all that shit. And, you know, we had redneck problems of guys in pickup trucks or going around to beat people like me. And that, you know, that kind of persecution, I kind of, you know, I kind of fed off of that.
I like
I kinda,
that.
You know, there's something about, you know, you're really kind of sticking up for yourself. Like, if people want to kill you for what you're doing, you must be doing something right, right?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, you're like, oh, I know I'm onto something here because this is provoking such a negative reaction
absolutely.
In them. Like, why is this so, you know, unsettling
exactly.
and disturbing to them? It must be exciting.
Yep.
Did
yep,
you always have the musical connection with Roddy? Was he on that same trip with you, or was he going down a different musical path?
We went back and forth. I mean, you know, we're talking like since we were 10, I'm 57 now. What is that, 47 years? We've had our, in our teen years, we kind of came back. But we had very, in the beginning, we had very close taste because we were, he always kind of was pretty adventurous musically. There was a record store on our street. It's called Larchmont. It's a street in L.A. And the record store guy, I don't know how, but he kind of turned us on to stuff like Sparks.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't know what the fuck that was.
Yeah, imagine.
Just some guy that looks like
10.
Hitler, right? I mean, yeah. really, we were about 11, 12 years old.
Yeah, that's going to blow your mind.
But Roddy was, you know, playing piano. He was taking piano lessons. So there was a little bit of a connection there. And we totally got into that. So there was a lot of adventure stuff. And then high school happened. I kind of got into the punk thing. He didn't really. But we, when I moved to San Francisco, he moved to San Francisco. And we were about 18 then, and then we kind of got back in sync again.
When you got to San Francisco, what year did you arrive there?
1981.
So is thrash the thing there? Is that what's the most dominant sort of musical movement at that time with Metallica and Exodus? Or what was going on in the Bay Area musically that sort of seemed to be the dominant scene at that point?
Thrash was happening in the East Bay around, I would say, there was a place called the Record Vault on Polk Street. There was a metal store, but San Francisco was never really like a metal town, but
was
that's
it, was it still the sort
like
of hippie
82?
Town? Was it still the hangover from that?
Yes, because 1981 was only 10 years after 1971.
Yeah.
So there were still, I mean, you know, you could say they were homeless people, but they were actually hippies on, you know, perpetual acid trips. There was a lot of that. And a lot of kids that I knew and a lot of punks in the scene, like their parents were hippies. And, you know, these kids took acid at very early ages, for example. Like, so that culture was very, very still here. It was still present.
Were you inspired or attracted to that, to the hippie, psychedelic, mind expansive, Timothy Leary journeys? Did you go down that avenue for a time?
I did in a real weird way. Like LA, not at all. And I hated hippies. And I came up here and, you know, here's the thing about L.A. and San Francisco. They're really like two different countries.
Yeah, I
where,
can imagine.
You know, there's a punk scene in L.A. And, you know, from like my years of, you know, 17 to 18 years old, you know, I went to a million gigs. And I don't think I ever talked about books or movies or politics with anybody. You know, it was all really kind of like, I don't know. I don't know what it was. But we talked about everything else. You know, talk about getting wasted or stuff like that. But I came to San Francisco, all of a sudden people went to see films, you know, and they read books. And the hippie thing, the mind expansion thing kind of actually came from that, where, you know, in this city, because they had a psychedelic, you know, experience here, you could actually take acid in San Francisco and you could walk around and you wouldn't have to be paranoid about getting arrested because it just it wasn't a big deal. Where LA, if you're smoking a joint, you know, you were scared to death of like a highway patrol or a sheriff catching you.
Yep.
It was very, very aggressive. Really different culture.
And I guess, obviously, San Francisco would have had at that point in time, especially crime and poverty and all those things. But was it less dangerous as well? Or was it, did it still have the danger element? Just perhaps it was a bit more liberal and laxed in that legal sense.
I think LA was always more dangerous. I think it was always more of a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
But I would say the economy here was much more depressed up here. So it was there was really nothing going on in San Francisco, like economically. It was dead. You know, so you got the great things like probably, you know, some ways a Brixton might have been like,
yeah,
you could just put on a club and the cops didn't really care what you did as long as you weren't killing each other, right? And LA was always a little more aggressive and controlled.
What's San Francisco like now? Like a just a completely unrecognizable city from the one you moved to in 1981?
It is. And I live on the same block really in the same neighborhood. I've been here since about 84. It looks the same in some ways, but yeah, I think the majority of people have probably moved here in the past 10 years and they came for work. And there was, there's a lot of tech work, obviously. Things got very expensive. A lot of my friends I've known from here have all kind of moved out.
So has it changed from an artist community to a more, what's the word, like when you start a business from nothing and flip it quick, what are they called?
Oh, you
startup
mean like
company stuff. Startup company.
That's all startup. That's
yeah.
all it is.
Yeah.
It's all that. The art itself, I mean, we got this horrible thing. This might have happened in London where, people, want to live in the city. They're working in Silicon Valley. They want to live in San Francisco where all the good restaurants and, the culture is. They get a place near, the club where there's bands playing so that they can, meet their future husband or wife,
Sure.
They meet them, they have a kid, and then they want to close the club down because, they can't sleep at night.
Yeah.
So we've had a lot of like recording studios closing, clubs closing, live music was really, before this pandemic hit, it was already pretty serious jeopardy.
Yeah. And I wonder with what's happened, how many, venues will last, and will return. It's really quite worrying to think about. The only thing that gives me, and we won't go too much into the COVID because we don't want to spend the whole day talking about that. But the only thing that gives me hope about it is I think sometimes new things just have to like start from scratch. Change is the only constant in life, right? And I feel like sometimes maybe you do just need to wipe out the playing field and people need to just get together in small community-based, spaces or whatever and kind of start again, rebuild. I don't know whether that's like a dream that's naive, but I feel like it'll always happen, right? There'll always be people that want to get together with like-minded people and make cool stuff, and that will happen regardless.
I think there's better times and worse times, but it's also how you the lens you view it in, because if there's always too much of one thing, there's always water, it always finds its lower spot where there's a vacuum and it goes to that. I think that there is always a correction mechanism. I think with our generation, we might, but people, a lot younger than us are doing might not seem very attractive and they might not make much sense. But, in a lot of ways, what they're doing is finding the holes that we kind of left behind as well.
Yeah, which is what you guys would have done, with the holes that were left behind by the generation before, with that kind of failure
of the
psychedelic 60s revolution, right?
Absolutely that. Totally. Totally.
How do you meet Mike Borden and Chuck? And how?
Chuck.
I guess like Jim Martin as well. Are you all in San Francisco at that time, at the same clubs, at the same venues? How does the five piece that was the sort of
no,
we care a lot never, lineup come together?
We were all really different people. The kind of comic tragedy of Faith No More is that we probably never should have met each other. But I think certainly not stayed together. But the fact that we did probably created something that we couldn't have done on our own as individuals. So, I think it speaks for itself. It's just that, it wasn't an easy process. But Chuck, I knew, he was a keyboard player in a band, but before I'd moved to San Francisco, he was in LA. And my first band I ever played in, Chuck was in the band. I think I met him when I was like 15. And he wasn't a singer. He never sang. The reason he sang was because Roddy, Mike Borden, and I were doing this Faith No More stuff where we were changing different singers, and we had a gig in L.A. We just booked the gig, and we didn't have a singer. And he was just hanging out. We just told him to come up on the microphone and start screaming, and he did.
Amazing.
And he liked it, so we asked him to do it again, you know, and that's pretty much how it started.
So you didn't have a guitar player at that point, or what was going on?
We didn't have one for that gig. I'm in the beginning, you know, okay, we're 18 years old, or 19 maybe now, and we had this ambitious project that every gig was going to be completely different music with a different singer and a different guitar player, and, you know, we were kind of...
Amazing.
That's where we started.
Well, that was that time, wasn't it, right? You had bands like Jane's Addiction doing
no
similar crazy stuff.
Right.
And
I mean, we weren't building a career, like, let's put it that way. Just making performances.
And Jim was old pals with Cliff Burton, right? They were in a band together. Like, was
yes.
it Agents of Misfortune?
Yeah, I met Borden from a record store. When I moved to San Francisco, I put an ad on a record store looking for a band because that's the first thing I wanted to do when I got here. And he was the guy playing with the guys who responded to my ad. So I met him that way. Now, he started playing drums with Cliff Burton. They went to school together, and Jim Martin was in that crew. So it was Borden, Cliff, and Jim. They left on very, very bad terms. It's still like, it's still up for discussion on who quit and who left and who got fired. But needless to say, when we were looking for new guitar players, we were trying different guitar players all the time. There was something that was missing that we wanted that we weren't getting. And that was like this kind of really heaviness. We wanted a little more power.
Yeah.
And Mike was like, I know this guy, Jim, he's an asshole, but he can do it. and that was it. The rest is history.
I love it. I absolutely love it. So that kind of, as you say, there's a real mix of different personalities. That creative tension was always there, was it? And it fed into the art and made it what it was. But it wasn't the case that it was all fun and games.
The fun and games were kind of edgy.
Yeah.
It was, you know, part of the fun was relief. There was a release of tension, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, I watched, there's this funny documentary on you guys on YouTube. It's not like a produced film. It's just like 3.5 hours of raw footage. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's...
I don't know, no.
It's from the period of the recording of Angel Dust. So it's basically just a guy with a video camera just in the studio with you all, and then there's a bunch of interviews afterwards, and they're interviewing Jim, and he's just so pissed off. He's like, they've left me no space to put any guitars anywhere. They're talking about calling this thing Angel Dust, and I just want to like go on record and say, if that's what it's called, it's got nothing to do with me, fucking disco music, all this stuff. And then Mike Patton comes in afterwards, and he's like, yeah, there's a guy in this band who hates disco, but the rest of us all love it. And you can just see, and he's like, we're gonna like, I probably just put an ad out saying like, Faith No More guitarist needed to replace this guy. And you can just see like it's kind of there on display, just like, as you say, the wind up.
Oh yeah, well, you know, I mean, yeah. Jim was kind of I actually got along with him really well. He was a really fun guy to hang out with, but he tended to dig himself into some holes and where it kind of looked like we kind of dogpiled on him a lot. But he's a smart guy. He gave it as good as he got it, man.
Yeah.
We were all like that with each other. I mean, it was all on.
Well, it looked like it was a fun process. There's another clip where you and Roddy are both at like a keyboard, and he's putting on like wave sound effects, and then you're adding like seagull sound effects, and you're just in hysterics, like having the time of your life, just doing all these silly samples.
Yeah, I don't know if I should watch that or not, but it'd probably take me right there. It sounds about right.
It's so just 90s and charming, you know, when just the video footage of that era has that look.
That's cool.
It says play in the corner of the screen. And
that's funny.
It was a fun watch. What would you consider to be like the kind of the real debut for the band? Would you consider it to be Introduce Yourself? Because I know you'd done a record before that, but it seems like it just started to fall into place for the first time, obviously with We Care A Lot being that big standout moment on the record. But
that's when we went to Slash. Okay, so we did that. We Care A Lot. It was a college hit in the States, and toured, I mean, you know, but the record wasn't available everywhere. But to us, that was really our big thing. We left San Francisco to go on tour. Like, that was huge.
Yeah.
Then Slash picked us up. It was Introduce Yourself. That really actually did probably open the doors to the world. Yeah. MTV, I think, played a video for the first time. And we were taken seriously. Like, we're, you know, the label would say, who do you want to produce this? And we could, like, actually, you know, make a list. And it was actually possible. You know, really strange and great. And actually, to be honest, Slash were really, really encouraging with us. They kind of got what we were doing. And it was great.
How many records did you do with them?
We did all of them with them. But there was a certain point with the real thing where they kind of had a deal with Warner Brothers where, you know, if it got to become more work, they would just pass it on to them. They could do that. So we became a Reprise, a Warner Reprise band, even though technically we'd signed to Slash.
And assumedly, because, you know, all those records are so different, assumedly you were given like kind of creative control and free reign to do what you want. Was that the case?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we knew in the beginning, like, it was this big thing, never go to a major, you know, they're the worst, they're going to kill you. And there was, you know, countless, you know, examples of all the people have been ruined by majors. And we kind of decided, well, you know, we kind of think this thing we have actually could be heard by a lot of people. And we're going to, you know, one of our core things from the beginning is nobody will ever tell us what to do, ever. I mean, that was really, I think that was something that we just kind of had to make sure would never happen if we were going to go down that route. And so we were on all the records and all the recordings and all the writing we did, we kind of pretty much, you know, reserved the right to, you know, basically approve or not approve it. And that's the way we related to our managers. That's the way we related to our label. It was like, this is it, you know, we'll work with you to a point, but you know, this is what it's going to be.
That's a really shrewd move on the part of, you know, young guys starting out. How did you have that foresight? Was it advice that you'd been passed on, or did you just sort of see it for what it was and know that you had to take care of yourself from day one?
Well,
if only more bands had that, right?
Right. Well, I mean, it's also like, you know, everybody says majors are bad, you know, and it's like, you want to discover things for yourself. You want to be able to see them for yourself. Like, I don't want to believe all majors are bad because majors are bad, you know. I wanted to see how, and I wanted to see if we do these safeguards, can they be bad, or is there some way we can kind of utilize them like a tool? And, you know, it's tough to say that we were completely successful because it was a huge industry with a lot of facets we could have never seen coming. But I think somehow at our core, I think, our intuition was correct. We didn't have anybody really advising us that much. And the more successful we got, the harder it got, because nobody really wants to give you advice for longevity, I noticed, or what's good for yourself. What they want to do is maximize what they have now, because especially a band like ours that was hard to define anyway, how long can the shelf life possibly be, right? So all these people who are supporters actually didn't really see much longer than 3 or 4 years out of us. They never told us that. But in all of their advice, it was probably things that were counter to what would have, you know, in the long term made us a healthier unit.
How far into, you know, the story of the band did Chuck's behavior start to become a little bit erratic and unpredictable? And did it become
always an erratic an unpredictable guy since I've known him,
right?
Always. And that's what I loved about him. But when he became our singer and our face to the world, it mattered, right? And that was kind of built in his nature to be that way. When he was on, he was hilarious. But, you know, it was really hard to get things done. It was really hard to make plans because they were constantly getting sabotaged.
And that
was just from the beginning. It was always like that.
Was there one moment or just like a few, a build up where I guess like you, Roddy, Mike, Jim sort of had to look at each other and say like, well, if we are going to continue, maybe we need to have a rethink here.
We had a few of them and not everybody was always on board. You know, getting into the psychology of it, I would say we all kind of had, you know, it's like a family dynamic. Everybody kind of has their strengths and weaknesses they put into this unit thing. I think Roddy was probably the one who keeps the glue that kind of keeps people together in a way. And so even dysfunction, like, I think Roddy kind of felt was worth keeping because it kept the family together. And that I think that in a way that kind of made things a little bit worse. There was a time when we, for sure, it had to be done. There were a couple times. We had a gig with Public Image, like, actually, here's a big one. The first time when we signed to Slash, our first gig that we did was a club in LA called The Lingerie. And everybody came. They just pulled all the media. Like, we got this great band and doing this great stuff. Like, you know, it's really different, you know. And we were, this was it, right? And Chuck just was drunk out of his mind. He fell asleep on one song. And basically.
On stage mid-set.
Yeah, on stage.
Yeah.
Where it took about 2 years of touring to get the music media to take us seriously again. Like, that gig was just, the word got out that we were just so shitty.
Wow.
So
yeah.
That's tough, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an industry in a town that talks as well, isn't it? And as you say, like, once something like that has happened and that news is out there, it's hard to damage control that and reverse the tide.
And I'm only saying this knowing this in retrospect. Like, I didn't know that at the time, but that's what happened. But we knew he fucked up. And everything was just, it got a little chillier.
Was it nice for you to reconnect? And obviously, I know you got to play with him before he passed, didn't you? Which must have been nice. Yep. To come full circle. And did that feel like when you got to play together then that you all made peace with the past?
In some ways, it did. He was really worried about, fucking up, actually. And I was, like, not worried about him fucking up. And in 40 years, we'd never been like that with each other, right? So it was really good to do that. I think he knew that he was on his way out, and I think that gig meant a lot to him, more than I probably realized. But it was really good. I think a lot of people that came to that show were people that knew both of us before there was a Faith No More. So it was a really cool grounding thing to do.
And was it just a case, and it's okay if you don't want to get into it, but was it just a case of, like, the lifestyle catching up with him?
Absolutely that.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's sad, isn't it?
It's hard to age doing that, you know?
Yeah.
It gets harder and harder.
How do you discover young Patton? How does he enter the fold?
We played a gig up in Northern California. Chuck was in the band, and somebody gave us a cassette tape. I think it was Trey in the band, and it was metal. It was pretty metal. And I wasn't that interested. It didn't really grab me, but Jim Martin loved it and was playing it on the bus all the time, or in the van all the time. And when the thing with Chuck just wasn't working out, Jim was just like, Mr. Bungle, Mr. Bungle, get the guy from Mr. Bungle. And I was just like, oh man, it's going to be some dude to hang out with Jim and drink beer, you know, and like some metal dude.
Yeah.
That's the last thing I want to deal with. and then Mike came, and it was like completely the opposite of that. And Jim was actually a little bummed, like, right? Mike had never even been in a bar before. Like, he was a kid, man. He was a kid.
He seems like he's about 10 years older than the rest of the... younger. Is he about 10 years younger than you guys? Yeah,
10 years younger. Yeah, I was about 27, 28. He was about 19, 20. Yeah.
That's wild. So he would have been, because on this documentary I was telling you about, he seems like so much younger than you guys then, because he's just so young, so fresh-faced.
Totally. I mean, you know, in some ways, yeah, it was a real strange thing. I mean, bringing him into our world, because we were coming from a scene. We've been touring, we've been making records. Our friends were all punks and stuff. And, you know, you bring this kid in there, and everybody's like, why are you doing that? And the weirdest thing is we went, you know, we tried out like probably 15 people, you know, with the music we were writing, and people didn't really seem to get it. I don't know why. To me, our music's really simple, but people weren't grabbing it. And Mike just grabbed it the second he heard it. He just it just was very natural to him. And it's like, you know, if you look at it from a musical point of view, this is the right guy.
Well, I was reading, tell me whether or not this is true. Obviously, you'd done all the music pretty much for The Real Thing. That was kind of almost all done, if not all done. Did Mike write all the lyrics for the album in a period of about 2 weeks over your music?
Pretty much. Yep. Very quick. He didn't know anybody in San Francisco. He was living in a room in Borden's house, and I think he just had nothing to do but write, and he did. And he cranked all that out.
At the age of 19, 20, to churn out songs like that, in that, you know, speed of time is really, really, right. It's quite astounding, isn't it? Did you see, as soon as he started presenting his ideas to you, like the talent in him right away? Were you like, oh, God, yeah, this is the kid?
I did. What I knew is because I had a little four track. And what we would do is we'd get like a, you know, two microphones and record a song in the rehearsal room. And then, you know, he could practice his vocals over that, you know, on my four track, come over to my house. And he had some ideas for stuff. And it's like, I remember turning the four track on and he just like sang. And I was like, oh my God, it already sounds like a finished song. Like, what the fuck? It was like, oh my God moment. It was very interesting. You don't have that very often. I haven't.
No, well, I mean, it's magic, I think, when moments like that happen, yeah. and to see it,
it
unfold.
When I heard it on the shitty recording on the shitty four track, I knew it already. I already heard what it was, where it was going to go and what it was going to do.
What did you think of the topics he was delving into as well? Because he goes to some quite, some very funny and also some pretty dark places as well. Did you have to kind of like rein him in at any point, or did you let him just do his thing?
Oh yeah, completely let him do his thing. I mean, we were coming from some pretty dark places ourselves.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I think when he came over to try out for the band, I mean, I lived in an old abandoned animal hospital, and it was like just like holes in the walls, and John Waters was like playing on the TV like at full blast. Like, you know, I don't know what he thought about that, right? But I wasn't anyone to, you know, give him any moral guidance. That's for sure.
I think Falling to Pieces off that album is the one for me. Whenever I'm DJing out, that's always my go-to tune. But just
really,
I love it. That's my jam, huh. From that album. It's just, I don't know what it is. I think it's just, I mean, it's everything about it at once just hits the spot for me. Epic was the one though, right? That was like, that was the kind of huge big song. Did that change the course of the band's career, would you say, the success of that song and the video? And
that stuff didn't come until a year and a half after the album had come out.
So right.
We toured that thing for a year and a half before anybody really cared about that song or that album. So when it did happen, it was pretty defining, but we were already pretty tired.
So when they you took some time off after The Real Thing, you didn't really take time off. It's just that it took the world time to catch up with you guys.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way it went down.
And, I mean, the real deal, I mean, like the management said, hey, guys, it's working. We got it going. You know, the tour is ending. You guys got to get back in and start writing again. And we've been touring for about probably on and off for 18 months, you know, and not really good touring because we weren't making a lot of money, you know, more than half of that was just in a van.
Yeah.
So, you know, the last thing we wanted to do was just get on the treadmill. I mean, you know, and yeah, that was a tough time. It was a tough time because we had to work. We needed it, but I don't know if it was really that healthy for us.
Is there a story that you could share regarding Bjork and a fish?
Oh, that's just completely made up. I don't even know where that came from.
Is it really?
It was some fishmonger. Yeah, it was some dude, some animal trainer. And we did it in London, and we wanted a fish. We wanted a fish gasping for air. That was pretty much – that was actually – I think that was my idea, actually. Like, they had all these ideas, like, what do you want to do for the video? And I was like, thinking, just take a fish, take it out of water, make the grass wear for a few minutes and just do it in slow motion. That's all that's my input.
And that's for the piano outro at the end, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And, you know, it wasn't anything cruel to the fish because it really was only really out for like 5 seconds. But, we had like, some guy who came from some aquarium in London who was like an animal keeper for films and, just came in with his fish.
That's brilliant.
And he left.
Because there's a quote on record somewhere from Bjork saying, I couldn't say either way, but all I could say is if I'd have just taken my fish home like I was supposed to. Then, so she obviously enjoyed playing along with it as well.
That's cool.
Angel Dust. I'd love to talk to you about that one. And that's the kind of the period which I saw in this documentary. And for me, that was the record which kind of turned me on to adult music, I would say. Like when I was a kid growing up, discovering punk and metal and rock and all of those amazing genres that I still love to this day, here comes this thing with what looks like a heron, a bird on the cover. And it was just so atmospheric and cinematic and foreboding and provocative and challenging for my mind at that time to try and process and comprehend. And everything about it, I think, just really encapsulated what was so special about your band, the combination of kind of aggression and beauty. And I just love that album so much. And it's, you know, still such an amazing album. Whenever you put it on, it just stands the test of time so well. Going into the studio to make that one, Mike had taken some time off to do Mr. Bungle. Is that right?
He did.
So had that kind of reset the sort of the plate, as it were?
Go ahead. Reset. What were you saying about the reset?
Like him going off to do that, did that sort of give him the chance to kind of reset his creative brain? So did he come back in, obviously, as an older guy, done his own thing? Did he kind of come in like a new reinvigorated artist ready to work with you all together on the music for that one?
I don't know. He didn't tell us. We just, with Mike, it's what you get is what you get.
Right.
And he didn't, he was never much of a guy who explained it. So
he was more hands-on involved
a couple things
with the music though, right? He took on a bit more of a role.
He was more involved with the music. He was. And we were after touring the real thing and playing those songs for a year and a half. I mean, some things, like I would say Jim and maybe even Borden, probably those are very conventional record for us. And they probably might have wanted to go more in that way. And where I was kind of like, okay, everybody's watching us. Everybody's kind of hearing, they want to hear what we're doing now, finally, with this weird music. Let's really take it somewhere now that people's ears are open. So that was kind of my point. And Roddy was pretty much along with that too. He was up for that. And Mike Patton was as well. But, it started becoming a little bit of this kind of energy on like we weren't quite all sure that that's where we wanted to go. And as you saw in that video, Jim wasn't pretty down with it at all.
To say the least.
Yeah.
And that was no secret then. Was it a fun process for you from a writing and a producing point of view? Like, because you come across like the real, like, science lab wizard type dude. Like, in all the clips that you're in, you're there at the board and you just, like, you seem like you're running from instrument to instrument, just having the time of your life.
I was always involved. Like, even with every producers we have, we always did pre-production on our own, and I was always really deeply into that. I think a lot of bass players get into the recording aspect of things for some reason. I'm not sure why, but I was one of those guys. And so I was always in the studio, no matter what anybody was doing. And having a place like Coast Recorders, where we had a budget where we could be there for 2 months to make a record, I mean, I wanted to be there and learn everything I could and be there the whole step of the process. Absolutely.
And so that obviously was what went into you kind of starting your label and working as a producer in those intermittent years and kind of exercising those muscles in that time.
Well, it came later. I didn't think about myself like that. I was just doing it because I was into it. But after, when Faith No More, after the album of the year, and I realized that shit needed to get done, I kind of saw that, over the years of being around all that time, I'd kind of picked some things up and, I should probably continue with that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites.
So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You've done some pretty amazing side projects like that I think a couple are known about, but the Shandy's Addiction thing sounds super interesting. Was that just like a one-off for the Kiss record? Yep. It wasn't like a touring band or anything?
No, Kiss, we're doing a compilation of a tribute record to themselves.
Of course.
And of course, right? And they wanted other bands to do covers of their songs, and they wanted to call it Kiss My Ass. And so our manager at the time, like, we had a little bit of downtime, and he was like, hey, you know, they were managing Rage Against the Machine too, and they said, so Kiss is doing this thing, and Tom and Brad are, you know, want to do this cover, you want to play bass on it. I was like, yeah, sure, why not, you know? And I just met him down in LA for a day. We banged it out like right away. We rehearsed it for like an hour. We recorded it. That was it. And I guess Tom's old roommate Maynard, you know, wanted to sing on it. So Tool was kind of starting then. And I picked him up in San Francisco. We went to the studio and he did his vocals in about an hour. And that was really it.
Faith against the Tool. It's an amazing it's an amazing mix of personalities. It's a really interesting cover as well.
Well, you know, the really great thing about it was it was an amazing mix of personalities back then, before we were personalities. So we were actually just being who we were, doing what we did. And I think that was really why it came and went as easily as it was. I wonder if we didn't know each other, we had to do this now, knowing who each other were, I bet it would be a lot more difficult.
Yeah, there's something to be said for just the purity and the excitement when experience hasn't jaded you, right? You're just hungry and excited and ready to go.
It does get more hard to do. Yep.
It seems weird to me that Maynard and Tom Morello would live together, being the two completely different figures that they are now. That's a trip. But he's obviously on their first record as well, isn't he?
And actually, you know, Maynard is actually, he's a pretty funny guy. I mean, I like him. I can't say I really know him like that. I've spent a lot of time with him, but the time I have spent with him, I've really enjoyed him.
I imagine him and Mike would be an interesting pairing.
You know, I would have thought so too, but I guess I think they like each other, but I don't think they clicked the way I would have thought they would have.
No? Too similar, perhaps.
I would have thought the same.
Two immovable objects. Like,
you know, Maynard is really, part of his thing is his dryness, his humor, that gets lost on a lot of people.
Yeah, he's a big comedy guy, isn't he?
Extremely dry. Oh my god!
How was the crazy tour that you did with Guns N' Roses and Metallica? They said it would never happen. Tour. How was that for you guys? How did you go over with the crowds as well?
Crowds didn't really care for us one way or another. I think great that the bands were supporting us. You know, GNR were totally. I mean, they really helped us. Actually, I don't think, you know, if they didn't say we were cool, I think a lot of people probably wouldn't have, you know, made the extra effort to listen to our music the way they did. So, you know, they really did help us. But by the time we hooked up with them, when we were touring, they were this hugest band in the world. And there was just like so much security. There was so much like them going on late. There was so much like non-spontaneity in that environment. And we did it for about 6 months. It was really hard on us. I can't say we had really, it was tough. And it's tough because they were very supportive of us, but we really, it wasn't very healthy for us.
And yeah, I mean, it ultimately broke up that band as well, didn't it?
Well, they were going that direction. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It was headed there. But, you know, and that's happening, you know, with this band, with this giant, you know, machine running, and it's really not healthy at the core. That all filters down, and you know, we're a little lower down on the feeding trough. So by the time it gets to us, there's just a lot of like nervous energy. There's a lot of just unpleasantness, I should say, general unpleasantness. And even when people are trying to be pleasant, you know, there's just a certain thing that you feel. There's not a lot of joy, if that makes any sense.
I imagine it's like if you go and visit your friend at their house and their parents are fighting and you're a guest who's been invited to be there and they're not trying to make you feel unwelcome, but just because of the mood in the house, you feel it and it feeds into you and it kind of ruins your experience.
Great analogy. That's right? And then another thing is, you know, we're doing this tour, and you know, we were playing for like, you know, 25,000 people in a stadium, but you know, people come up to me, you know, go like, we would play 3 hours before they would go because it always go on late, and so we, you know, there'd be like, you know, 2,000 people out there to see us because why is anybody going to get there early when the band doesn't go on for another 3 hours?
Yeah.
So it's an empty place, and you know, writers come out just go, how does it feel to be on the greatest, biggest tour in the world? You know, and it was ludicrous. You know, it was like you know, it's like suddenly Trump saying, yeah, we're leading the world on the coronavirus.
You know? Yeah, sure
it's
you
like
are.
Like, weird. Nobody does it better than the United States. This is the best response to a coronavirus disease in U.S. history, you know? It's just, there's something about it that's just like, fuck this.
How are the Booyah Tribe? I rewatched that music video the other day, and it just made me miss the 90s. I was like, imagine that happening today, like a project that exciting and dangerous, and everybody in it's just like a radical artist at that time, and that video is so dark and like just cool.
It was amazing because we didn't know them. We just kind of thought about them, called them up on the phone. They had some studio time because they were making a record. We just showed up. I didn't even play bass. They because they have a bass player. They just said, "Let's turn on the tape and let's just start jamming."
Amazing.
And that's what that was. And it was like on a musical level. I mean, we did this like 40-minute jam, and they forgot to hit the record button. And that was the best. That was fucking amazing. And then it's like, shit, we didn't get that. And then we did it again, and what you got was part of that that they edited it up. But it was. It was exactly like how it felt in the video and the song. Like, we really connected. It was really fantastic.
If anybody hasn't seen that, listening to this, it is the Anybody Got Murdered video off the Amazing Judgment Night soundtrack in 94, which was, I guess, was that your first outing without Jim?
It was. Jim didn't want to do it. We were going to play with these guys, and he was like, fuck that shit.
And so,
okay, well,
that's it right there.
I'm going to go.
Yeah.
Well, we were already kind of, you know, hip hop, you know, Jim wasn't into that, you know, so he was like, don't worry about it, Jim. We're just going to go do it anyway.
And then what happens? And then does he walk? Do you boot? Is it a bit of both?
He was walking, but it took a while. It took a couple more years. We were writing King for a Day, I think, when that all transpired. Because, you know, when you get to a certain point, when you're a successful group, you know, you just don't walk away from that. You know, you have to make a settlement.
Yeah.
So that took time. It took negotiation and time, and that's what happened.
And at that period, obviously it was around the death of Kurt. And I know from speaking to Kevin Kerslake that, I don't know whether he said you as well, but certainly Roddy were like childhood friends of Courtney and grew up sort of with her. So they were obviously close. Were you close with Courtney as well? Or was it more Roddy's friend?
She used to be our singer, right?
Yeah, I was reading
he
this.
Sang in our band.
So this is a true bit of Faith No More trivia.
Yeah. For like 3 or 4 months, she was a singer. So
wow.
Yeah, there was a certain period of time where we were extremely close. I would say for about a year. And
this is before Chuck.
I haven't spoken with her since then. Chuck.
Yeah, she was in the band for 3 months before Chuck. Wow. What's that?
Yep.
How was that? How was that dynamic? Was she wild? Like
she
on the
was.
On the mic? Was she just a force?
Yes, personality wise, she was not afraid of anything, and she engaged the audience, she insulted them, and it was fantastic, actually, that part. The part that wasn't so, I don't think that on a musical level we really connected, so that part wasn't so great.
So she is obviously going through hell after Kurt's death. I guess is Roddy sort of taking on a bit of that and feeling it as well? Because he was kind of absent for a lot of the King for a Day sessions, right?
He, you know, he went through the program around that same time. So he had a couple friends, not just Kirk that died, and it was substance related. And he was, you know, trying to get himself off of them himself at that time. So Roddy was having a tough time. And, he was pretty detached making King for a Day, which I can, you know, completely understand, but it was tough at the time.
How tough was that for you? Because obviously, not only your close friend, but I guess he was kind of like your main writing partner within the band as well, right? So did that give the album a whole different feel when you were creating it? You have to sort of reinvent it, as it were, and obviously Jim's gone.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's really hard to say. All this stuff is so subjective. I can only think about what I brought into it, but with Jim, you know, kind of what I was talking about earlier, it took a while for us to separate, and maybe a year or two. Like, we knew it was going to happen, but it was a very painful, slow process. And I think when it finally did happen, it was like this, for me, it was this breath of fresh air where I just wanted this, like, whatever vibe Angel Dust had, I wanted to explode it, you know?
Yeah.
All that Technicolor richness and all that stuff, which we liked when we did it, I kind of started thinking about it as kind of being oppressive as well, and dark, and those feelings I had while we were touring it. And I wanted something that just felt like an impact and a bomb going off. So that was kind of what I brought into it. I don't know if Roddy felt that way or didn't feel that way. He wasn't really talking much. I think he was dealing with stuff that he didn't even know what he was dealing with. But we all, you know, we went to Bearsville in New York to record in Woodstock, which was this incredible studio, and had a beautiful piano there. We still, you know, we still had a lot of creative stuff that came out that was good, even with Roddy. But it was a really different energy. It was kind of like, well, we finally got through this, like, dysfunctional situation, and now we can, like, reclaim ourselves. And it didn't really happen the way I was hoping it would.
In terms of what, like, the response from the fans and...
No, well, I know that part, I don't even know. I mean, the record did pretty much fall flat, but that wasn't what I was thinking. It had more to do with, you know, wow, we can all connect with each other again. Like, all this thing that was really weighing us down, we kind of have risen past that. So now let's get back and do something really creative and good. And not everybody was all in sync, you know? So it was hard work. It was, making that record was very hard. It was very difficult and painful.
And how about the final one from round one?
That was very difficult and painful too. it's funny, on that record, really, of all the ones we did, that got the least reaction, least reception. And up back in the day, King for Day, that didn't get such a great reception. But, you know, it's funny now, like, a lot of people say that's their favorite record. And we were really happy. We were really proud of it when it came out. And even out on the year, we were as well. But it was a different vibe. It was a much sadder vibe, that's for sure. But I would think of all the records we've ever done, I probably connect with that one the most.
Which one? Album of the Year?
The last one, Album of the Year.
Yeah. I mean, there's that song on there. I love it. I don't think you've ever played it live. The She Loves Me Not. It's like just a loungy,
right,
really unusual song. But, well, I guess there is no such thing as an unusual Faith No More song. But just a really cool, like, point of difference in that record. And Pristina as well. Was that inspired by, did you take a trip out to the Balkans?
It was,
When that was going on. So how did that situation over there, like, impact and affect and inspire, if that's the right word, you?
You know, when you don't know what you're seeing, you go by what you feel, right? So I went through, it was in Kosovo, and the war hadn't kicked off yet, but it was obvious that it was going to. And there's just something you just get when you're there that you can never read about, you can never see on a TV. You just get it. And it's a feeling, right? And, you know, I don't think most people knew much about Kosovo because there hadn't been a war there yet. So there was really no reason for anybody to learn about it. And I just kind of wanted to, like, it was kind of a thing that left an impression that I kind of wanted to make a marker out of. That makes any sense.
Of course.
And I wanted to try to get that vibe, and I wanted to try to just, like, take a snapshot of it.
Because there's, like, across your life, there's a few political figures musically that are obviously, you know, huge and larger than life within their fields. Jello being one, and Wen Kramer mm-hmm. being another. Mm-hmm. Would you consider Faith No More in any way to be a kind of a politically inspired band? Is it in there? Or was that a very unique song
Absolutely.
For you guys?
No, I mean, one of the reasons that we have the variety we have is because you know, politics is also about defining issues, right?
Yeah.
And how you perceive issues and how numbers of people just perceive issues. And, you know, numbers of people that perceived my band, you know, and I don't like being defined by, you know, defining myself with cheap tricks. And I don't like being defined by other people's cheap tricks. And that's political. That's very much political. I mean, when I see, you know, when I see how people have perceived my band, and I've seen the machine that's created what it's created, and I've also seen how, you know, people see what they want to see, that applies to, you know, people getting health care. It applies to, you know, the justice system just as much as, you know, who they vote with when they buy their music. I think there's a complete connection there. So there's always politics. It wasn't the kind of politics where I would be like, you know, taking a political cause and you know, marching down the street with it. I wouldn't take politics the way Rage Against the Machine takes politics. I don't think anybody in my band would ever do that. But I think that living in this world and being part of the mass media, you are political. You cannot not be political.
I think it's interesting as well, because now more than ever, people like to sit on their computers or their phones and sort of rant on the internet and tell people that they've never met before what they think about their art or their lifestyle choices or whatever. And I think in this day and age, it's important for artists and humans to kind of defy that and fight against that, because I hate that so much, as you say, like kind of trying to put people in boxes and you know, restrict what we're allowed to do as humans. I'm not talking about running out and committing crimes. I'm talking about being free and, you know, living.
It's our quality of life. Yeah. You know, if for example, you know, they're trying to, you know, if they're trying to, you know, take down the NHS, you know, it's not just that they're trying to save money. You know, it's also that they're going to affect people's quality of life, you know, the way they react to each other. Because if somebody's sick, obviously their quality of life is going to be compromised, right? And if they can't pay for their medicines, they're going to be compromised. If you are not creating a space where you can express yourself and you are contributing to that space that tries to block that from happening, you're creating a worse world for yourself where there's less options, right?
Amen.
I mean, if people say, take them off in doors, you know, for bands, if we did, I would like to think it's because we gave them the possibility they can do whatever they want. I think it's important that exists in our world.
Yeah, and we need it now more than ever. I think it's getting getting more and more like safe and regimented, and yeah,
you have to fight for your quality of life. You have to.
How was hooking up with Jello Biafra for the Axis of Evildoers? I love that guy as an artist, as a songwriter. I've never had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with him, but he seems like he'd be an interesting guy to get to work with.
Great. He's great. He's one of a kind. He's amazing in that he writes everything and he doesn't play an instrument, so he sings into a tape recorder.
Wow, that's how he does all the parts, just vocally.
Yeah, yeah, he's amazing. It's amazing. And he hears things in my playing that I don't even hear. Like, he's very, very fine-tuned. He was an idol of mine when I was 15, 16 years old. So, you know, it meant a lot for me to connect with that. You know, he's still in San Francisco playing in a band, you know. He's still being the guy that he was and doing what he does. And he can't do anything else. And there's something really, I really respect and admire that.
Has he got a sharp mind as well? Is he somebody you can sit down and just have really great, in-depth, engaging, informative, entertaining conversations with?
Depends on his mood. If he doesn't want to, he definitely cannot.
Love it.
But no, he's quick. He's definitely quick.
And the other hero, an all-time hero, and I guess really like that first political punk band that, you know, were willing to go to jail for what they believed in, mm-hmm. Wayne Kramer. So I got to see you guys open up for Alice Cooper in London. I want to say it was last year. It seems like it was recent, but this year's thrown my sense of time
exactly
out the window.
Exactly a year ago.
Cool.
It was also exactly a year.
And it was you, Kim, Brendan, and the singer Marcus,
yeah.
And then you had the Stranglers after you guys. It was an amazing bill. Yeah. How do you get the offer, first of all, to go play with Wayne in the MC50? And then when you hear the lineup, did you just
Wayne
jump
already.
In? Right.
I knew him, and I liked him immediately. We hit it off when we first met. I met a friend, a mutual friend for lunch, and Wayne was there. And we just hit it off. And I didn't keep in regular contact with him over the years, but like every time I saw him, I was like, I feel like I just knew him already. So I hadn't talked to him in probably a couple of years, and I got a call just like, hey, Bill, it's Wayne. Hey, man, what are you up to? Well, I'm doing this tour in about, you know, a month, and the bass player didn't work out, so can you do it? And it's like, shit. Yeah, I mean, how can I say no to that? And that's kind of what happened, and I just stayed with the band. I mean, that was amazing. That was an amazing experience. I never knew Brendan before, and Fugazi were kind of like the East Coast Faith No More in a weird way. Like, we came up at the same time. We went to, we saw each other's gigs, but we didn't know each other. And he's awesome, man. He's awesome, and I wish I would have known him earlier. And he was so great to play with. He's a great drummer. It was fucking great. And Kim, I've known since the Soundgarden days. And, you know, Soundgarden, when Faith No More first came to Seattle back in, I don't even know what year that was, late 80s, Soundgarden opened up at the Central Tavern. There was like 20 people there.
Well, the last time...
So we go way back. We go way back.
The last time I saw Faith No More was the Hyde Park day, which was just one of the best days ever.
Oh, that was fun.
That was the last time I saw Soundgarden before Chris passed. It was the last time I saw Motorhead before Lemmy passed. And what an amazing day. What an amazing bill. And that was your first show back in the UK after, how long had it been? It had been a few years or a couple or more?
Yes, it had been a couple of years, actually. And it just came up. I think we got the call about that one-off gig, and we just took it. But we hadn't played in a while.
And you dropped a couple of new tracks, didn't you? You played Motherfucker and Superhero that day.
That's right. Yeah, we had already recorded the album by that point. And we hadn't really told anybody about it yet, but we just did it, yeah.
I love that because, yeah, you didn't announce it on the day either. You weren't like, this is new material and classic Faith No More way. You just went into them and everybody was like, I don't know this song. Is it another one of their covers that I don't know the original of? So good. What a great way to debut a song like Motherfucker as well. Just like with no fanfare, no material out, and you just go into a song like that. Incredible.
Yeah, that's kind of how we wanted to do it. And it was cool.
Did you approach Jim about a reunion? Did you invite him to be involved, or was he just not into it?
We did. We did about three times. We bungled the first two. But the third one's on him. We left on pretty bad terms, and we didn't. Basically, the communication kind of stopped. So it had been about maybe almost 20 years since we'd spoken. Wow. We decided to get back together to do these Brixton shows back in the 2009. We thought, well, let's see if Jim wants to do it. Why not? Can we do it? I don't know. I mean, obviously the drummer's a little shell-shocked because he's been through this twice already, right? We all were kind of like, I don't know, you know, if this could be a negative thing, I don't know if anybody wants to do it. We all kind of, you know, we had issues with each other too, you know, to do this. And It was pretty fragile, actually, when we decided to do it. You know, it would have been much easier just to kind of not do it. And Roddy called him, and he was like, I'll do it, blah, blah, blah. No problem. I don't care. This is a totally, completely not an emotional thing for me, you know. And so Roddy's like, wow, he says he'll do it. And this is, you know, that's great, you know. And somebody said something's, that's not right. That's not a right reaction. Like, it doesn't, he's, you know, that's not an honest reaction. That was with somebody, I don't know who brought it up, but I kind of agreed with that. Like, it's just something, like, it doesn't quite feel it. And John was like, who did the last record with us, he was kind of, really felt kind of like one of us. And we're like, you know, we know with John, like, there's a certain trust issue there that we'll have and where we can kind of do our gig. And we told Jim it wasn't going to work out. And he didn't react well. And that kind of, in a weird way, confirmed that it probably was right that we didn't do that.
Right. Yeah, these are very fragile things, aren't they, band relationships? Fragile.
You know, I'm not even going to point a finger at Jim and say he blew that. Or in a weird way, we probably shouldn't have approached him if we were that skittish about it. But it would have been, I don't think it would have worked out very well. I don't think we would have continued and made another album.
Another great album as well, your first one in 18 years. That must have been a incredibly unique experience. There's not many people that can say, you know, two decades almost go by and then you get back in the room with these old collaborators. And what sort of emotions come out during that process, all of them.
Pretty much.
It's wild. Yep.
Not all good ones.
Yeah.
All of it. Yeah, that's the process. It's therapy in a weird way. I think that almost always you're better off having done it than not done it if those things are flying around. But I can't say it's an easy thing to do.
Had you remained in contact, assumedly because you're old pals with Roddy, you two remained friends in that intermission. Mm-hmm. Had you kept up a relationship with Mike, well, the two Mikes?
Not really any of them. Didn't see any of them since the 98 till about 2009. So I don't know how many years that is, 11? Didn't talk to them much, maybe once or twice during that period. That includes Roddy, too. I kind of had enough. When Album of the Year was done, I'd had enough.
So you just go off, you're doing the label stuff and producing and doing other bands.
I want to do creative things that I want to enjoy doing. That was kind of my mindset. I'm just going to seek comfort in things that give me pleasure.
Who was the first person to extend the olive branch of friendship or, you know, a business opportunity?
My manager.
Right.
What happened was he had gotten married in Mexico, and I was invited to his wedding. So I went down at the airport, getting on the plane. Guess what? There's Roddy going down too. So I hadn't really seen him for about, years. And it was good. I spent the whole weekend hung out with him, had a great time. And it was like, oh, that's actually really cool. You know, it was really kind of cool thing. And then after that, he got married. I was out of town. I was out of the country, but those guys all went to his wedding and they connected probably in a similar way that I had with Roddy. That's kind of the momentum that kind of got it going.
Weddings, bringing people together, you see?
I guess. That's what they say.
And are you really pleased with that record, Sol Invictus? Like, it was such a great continuation, but also reinvention, as the others previously had been as well. Did you feel any pressure or fear to follow up on these first four records all these years later? Was there any, like, trepidation or doubt in your mind, or were you just hungry and excited to get in and try it out?
No doubt whatsoever. I kind of felt with the Album of the Year that we kind of split up before I really got to kind of speak my musical piece. I felt like I had more to say. And so I kept writing, you know, even though there was no band, I just kept writing music because I just felt like the final word hadn't been said. And so there was no fear on that side. What made it a little hard was, we didn't really want to tell anybody we were making a record because, you know, the Faith No More is making a record again, you know, and all this hype. And we kind of just wanted to just keep the volume down and just kind of try to make it a musical connection between ourselves. And so we didn't tell anybody. And what that means is, you know, then I'm going to be probably doing a lot of the engineering and stuff myself in the rehearsal room because, you know, we're not booking time even in studios. We're doing this completely on the down low. And I think that was a cool thing to do as far as the soul of the group to connect. I think for me, it made it a little difficult because I became so intimately involved in the process that I still hear every mistake on that record. I can't listen to it.
Oh, no, I know what you mean. I've edited a film, you know? And I liken it to that. It's you spend to the point where you begin to just see these wavelengths as like equations, and it's not like art anymore, it's science, and you go so stir crazy and mad, and as you say, I'll notice like one frame that's off, and I can sympathize with that because you're so close to it, aren't you?
The brain will do that. It will just get as meticulous as it wants to, right? And so I think it was a great thing we did. I'm happy with it. I could let it go. And I think it did what it needed to do, but I have a hard time listening to it.
And what's next for Faith No More? Or is it very much with a band like that, just we let time unfold as it will, and we just sort of roll with whatever happens along the way? Or do you actively make plans at this stage?
If I'm guilty of anything in the past, I've always been kind of the guy to crack the whip and get everybody focused to get on the next thing.
Yeah.
And to my detriment, I think people kind of have resented me for that, which, you know, rightly so. So I think that what I'm going to do this time is, I think when the band wants to do something, they're going to do it. And if they don't, I'm completely comfortable with that.
Right. That's cool.
Got to let it go.
So it is just the future's unwritten.
Where that gets us. Right. But if we do it, if something does come out of it, it will be a real natural thing that people want to do. And I think that's the only thing we can. That's the only way it should happen right now.
Yeah, that's beautifully honest.
If it's not like that, there's no fucking point doing it. There's enough noise in the world, really.
No, that's a great viewpoint to have, and I respect the few bands that do have that, though, and they're just like, you know what, if it happens and we want to do it, we will, but we're not just going to do it for the sake of it.
Nope.
The big show, though, that was going to be looking like the best show of this year, that's still going to go ahead, hopefully, next year, right, with System of a Down, Korn, Helmet, Russian Circles, and you guys. I saw that lineup and was like, oh, I'm coming out for that.
In LA?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know when. I don't think there's a date set.
I guess we'll have to wait and see then, won't we? Next year as well.
I don't think anybody knows anything. Yeah.
If there's any shows of that size next year, I think we'll all be lucky. And I hold out for it, but I don't, you know, I don't expect.
It's crazy, you know. I mean, you know, I'm 57 years old, you know. We're not spring chickens anymore. You know, one of us could get, you know, catch something.
Yeah. Well, I think.
I mean, you know, anything can happen in a year, right? I mean, all these bands, I'm sure a big percentage of bands that we've just taken for granted, just tours all the time, not going to exist anymore.
I think about that not in regards to Faith No More, but in regards certainly to bands like the Rolling Stones and.
Oh, for sure.
Aerosmith.
Absolutely.
And those guys that you just, you know, you take for granted, as you say, you think, yeah, I'll get to see AC/DC again. Hell yeah, they're in the studio at the moment making a new record. But, you know, yeah. If it's going to be another 12, 18, 24 months before that is a real, you know.
That's a lot.
A thing,
I mean,
again.
2 years off when you're 70 years old is like 10 years off when you're 30 years old.
Yeah.
It's tough to get back into that.
Sharon Osbourne said in a news article recently, Ozzy will tour in 2022.
He knows.
You just picture Ozzy at home like, fuck, you know. When can I retire? Do you love being on the road, though? I know you're a big studio guy. Do you love being on the road and playing live shows as well? Is that a big part of where you're most, you know, happy and at home?
I can. My perfectionism kind of gets to me a little bit, like to where it's so stupid, but my, you know, when you have, I wouldn't say it's stage fright, but before a gig, like I get so preoccupied with like that I'm going to be able to play it 100% that it just freaks me out. And after the second song, it's always fine. The gig's always good. I'm always happy, but there's this thing before the gig, the 2 hours before the gig, it's getting harder and harder. It's really, I can really feel it. It's a strange thing. And you know what? You know how it's really weird with me, how it shows up? It makes me, I get tired. It's not like I'm freaking out. It's not like I'm nervous. What happens is I get really tired and I don't have any energy. And I'm not going to have enough energy to go on stage. It's a very strange, strange phenomenon. And I noticed that when Faith No More started doing the gigs again, we started having that. And there's a certain things I think, you know, with more touring, you get a little better at it and you can manage it. But you know, when we start doing gigs again, it's even with MC50. I mean, it's a thing that happens. It's a thing that's real. I don't think it's going to go away.
I just imagine as well how much of a trip the first show for everybody is going to be, both audience and performers alike. It's going to be this collective moment where everybody's almost like re-experiencing something for the first time.
Weird.
It's going to be so wild, yeah. Isn't it?
It seems hard to imagine right now. It really is hard to imagine.
It does. I want to ask you one more question before I let you go, Billy, if that's okay. I've had a lovely time chatting to you, mate. And thank you so much for giving up your time and being a gent. Thank you to Dawn for being the best and setting it up.
I'm glad you've been interested to do it. That's great.
What is, if you had to pick one, your favorite Faith No More song and why?
Oof. Oh, I can't do that.
No,
I just can't answer that one. Yep.
Had to try it because I know you're so close to so many.
They're all different. Yeah. I don't know. Tell the truth, I don't really listen to that music. So it's kind of done. It's like once it's done, it's done. We'll play it live and all that, but it's not like I don't focus on it. I don't think about it. If I do, like I said before, if I'm in a bar or something and somebody's playing a song, I'm listening for mistakes.
Yeah. That makes sense.
It sucks, really. It really takes the pleasure out of it. But, you know. I would say though, of the albums though that I like, I think that would be the stuff off that is probably my favorite, even though it's not really high energy in some ways. It's a little more moody. There's something about it that it connects with me.
And are you happy with everything that's been, you know, laid on and documented forever? Is there still obviously much more to do, but are you content and happy with your body of work so far?
No, I'm not. I think there's things I could do better, and that's just the way it is. That's the nature of it, I think, too. And I definitely think there's room for improvement. I think the next record, if we do one, it'll sound different than the last one for sure. And I think it'll be in a forward direction.
I love it. And I guess that will always be the way it is, right? For people like yourself who are that way inclined to always improve on the list. It's good news for people who like what you do, but there never comes a time when you're like, I've completed it, I'm done. And that's, I think that's what keeps us young and keeps us excited about not just art, but life as well. I feel like that very much is there's always more to do and always better to do. And,
great to look forward to something always, right?
Exactly. Forwards, not backwards. Yep.
Exactly.
Amazing. I hope you have a great day, Billy. And either this side or your side, I hope one day we get to connect in person and hang out and have a beer and a chat in the real world.
Would love to do it.
Thank you, mate.
Thanks, Matt. Talk soon.
Sounds funny, but I just can't stand the pain. Girl, I'm leaving you tomorrow.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.